Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this rainy Saturday morning, May 12th, 2018. Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time, and you can hear us from anywhere on the planet online at 883WPPB.org. And each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com. How are we doing this morning? Wow, yesterday was absolutely gorgeous. Hope you got out, played some golf, did some gardening, went biking, maybe even boating, whatever. It was just gorgeous. Today, right now, it's 53 degrees, 60% chance of precipitation. Tomorrow, there'll be a high of 56 with a 30% chance of rain. And it's a little wet out there right now, not too bad, but hope you're having a great weekend. And this morning we're going to talk golf and baseball. All you baseball fans and sports historians, really, are going to want to hang in all hour. We're going to talk to Johnny Smith, co-author of this wonderful book called A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. All about Mickey's positive years, particularly in the 50s and 1956, the year he won the Triple Crown. Just really great stuff. So all you baseball fans, we're going to talk a little baseball in the second half of the show. And first half of the show, we will talk golf with East End's own Bob Bubka, who is at the TPC Sawgrass in Ponte Vedra, Florida for the Players Championship. And you guys know Bobby, voice of golf for Talk Sport Radio in the UK, the voice of golf for World Golf Radio, and for WLNG right out here on the east end of Long Island. And he also co-hosts the Grill Room show, heard on various digital platforms. So we're going to start by talking with Bobby in a few minutes. The Players' Championship, round three, Saturday, going on. Webb Simpson was 17 under yesterday with six straight birdies on pace to set a new course record. He was just in that zone. And then he gets to the par 3 17th signature hole with the island green. And you could see he was becoming a little indecisive about what club to hit, 147 yards to that island green. And sure enough, his tee shot hit that wood perimeter around the green, bounced hard off of it, but it bounced back onto the green. So everybody thought, oh, wow, well, maybe it will be fine. And then it kind of rolled too quickly and dropped off into the water. So Webb Simpson ended up double bogeying that hole. Then he parred the 18th to match the course record, a 10 under 63. He was the seventh player to shoot a 63 on the stadium course, and he's 15 under overall. And that ties the 36-hole record set 2 years ago by Jason Day. So he could have had all kinds of records, but that tough par three and that signature hole, Island Green, that everybody knows about when you say TPC, Sawgrass, that got the best of him. He leads Charles Schwartzel, Patrick Cantlay, and Danny Lee by five shots heading into today's third round. Well, Tiger Woods was the only player from his marquee pairing of himself, Phil Mickelson, and Ricky Fowler, who made the cut. And he made the cut on the number with some help from Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas, who both bogeyed the tough par 4 18th. Tiger shooting a 1-under par 71, 1-under overall for the tournament. So he stays to play the weekend. And, you know, he's been struggling with his irons. He had seven approach shots from within 125 yards or closer, but he couldn't hit any of those approach shots closer than 15 feet from the hole. So, and then his putting wasn't great. He did hit 8 of 14 fairways, 12 of 18 greens in regulation, and just continues to struggle with his irons, which was his main nemesis at the Masters this year. And as I said, meanwhile, Phil Mickelson, Ricky Fowler, Rory McIlroy all missed the cut. Boy, Rory just continues to struggle. Phil shot a 1 over 73, and then he had that 79 on Thursday. Just brutal. Ricky Fowler hitting onto the top of a palm tree from the tee on the sixth hole. Never found that ball. That continued. He continued his downward spiral from there. So Ricky goes home. So does Phil. Tiger stays in. And Phil and Rory McIlroy just hasn't been playing well. We'll talk to Bubka in a few minutes to find out what's happening with McIlroy. All right. Then in the second half of the show, as I mentioned, we'll talk about one of my favorite personalities in sports, the one and only Mickey Mantle. Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith, they co-wrote a book called A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle, describing the legendary New York Yankee during the 50s, and more specifically in 1956, when the Mick became the most celebrated athlete in the country and reigned as the king of the national pastime. In 1956, that was the year Mantle stepped out of the shadow of Ruth, Gehrig, and DiMaggio. And for the first time in his career, Yankee Stadium belonged just to him. He was like the star in The Natural, the blue-eyed, blonde-haired boy from the heartland, whose raw power and mystical purity made him a hero. That was the year that Mantle won the Triple Crown, marking his ascendance as the best player in the game. The book is beautifully written and thoroughly researched. And all you baseball fans, both young and old, will certainly enjoy hearing from Johnny Smith, co-author of A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. All right, well, in other news, we talked a little bit about the Kentucky Derby last year, and I have to give myself a pat on the back because this is the third straight year I actually picked the winner. Yeah, Justify came through, and now he will try to continue his quest to become the first horse to win the Triple Crown since 2015. At the Preakness, that's already next Saturday. So he's a 1-2 odds favorite at the Preakness. The post time next week is 6:20 Eastern at Pimlico Racecourse. And right behind Justify is Good Magic, who's listed as 9-2. So we'll see if Justify can continue on here, but I cannot believe I picked the winning horse three straight years. In baseball, the A's crushed the Yankees last night at Yankee Stadium 10-5. Chris Davis and Matt Chapman homering off of former Oakland ace Sonny Gray. Yes. And Yankees hosting the A's this afternoon in the second game of this three-game series. The first pitch is set for 105. And, of course, the Yankees have been on fire, winning 17 of their last 20. Michael Conforto and Devon Mesoraco, they hit back-to-back homers in the ninth inning to lift the Mets over the Phillies last night, 3-1 in Philadelphia. And meanwhile, Matt Harvey, former Met, enjoyed a successful Reds debut. And Scooter Gennett, he homered for a fourth straight game as the Reds defeated the Dodgers 6-2 at Dodger Stadium yesterday. The victory extended Sandy's season-high winning streak to 4 games, and this was the first appearance for Matt Harvey since the Reds acquired him in a trade on Tuesday. All right, we're going to come back, talk to our buddy Bob Bubka, who is calling us live from the Players' Championship, TPC Sawgrass in Florida. Sports Interview is brought to you in part by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, patented dual zone lens technology. Learn more at peakvision.com. And by Dune Jewelry and the new Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or spot in timeless pieces for both men and women. DuneJewelry.com. I'll be there for you. This is not a drive-by.
On the upside to a downward spiral, my love for you went viral. It's back. The Eclectic Cafe, our Sonic Gumbo. One-of-a-kind mix of music and conversations, music of all styles, classics, contemporary, what's trending in today's music world, and keeping up with what's happening on the East End. You need a guide? You got it. I'm Bonnie Grice. Join me weekday mornings 9 to noon for the Eclectic Cafe on WPPB, Long Island's only NPR station.
WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has an amazing community calendar on our site. Just go to 883wppb.org to the Community Calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week, on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883wppb.org.
Well, I was sitting, waiting, wishing you believed in superstitions. Then maybe you'd see the signs.
Little Jack Johnson to be mellow on this Saturday morning here in Southampton, New York. And joining me now live from the Players' Championship at TPC Sawgrass in Ponte Verde, Florida, is the Hamptons' own Bob Bupka. Bobby, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Ann, and thanks for having me on. Of course, exciting times in the world of golf. You know, this is probably the last super huge event before we go to where you are right now and be in Southampton at Shinnecock for the 19th playing of a U.S. Open in the state of New York, more than any other state, which I think is pretty remarkable.
How wonderful. It's going to be in our own backyard, probably a drive and a three wood right from this station. Bobby and I actually had the opportunity to play Shinnecock just Thursday in mist and wind. And I wonder if all the guys over there were saying maybe if it was like that for one day during those 4 days of the U.S. Open, the players would get a sense of maybe what the, you know, tough conditions really can be like. But it's such a tough course.
Well, it really is. I saw that great photo you put up of the par 5 16th hole, which they've added some distance to. It's going to play over 600 yards, so it really makes for a wonderful finish. I mean, 16, that is going to be that tough par 5, that unbelievable par 3 for 17, and then 18, as good a finishing hole as you're going to find in golf. So 16, 17, and 18 probably, more than likely, will be the deciding factors when we get to Shinnecock.
We've been talking about it for weeks now. I had Chip Beck on last week. I had your buddy Bob Joyce on. I had Darren Clark on. I mean, the buildup is so exciting. I'll definitely get to the Players' Championship in a second. But since we started with the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, Bobby, you probably have covered, what, maybe three of those U.S. Opens at Shinnecock?
I covered all four.
Four?
I was there
wow.
in 1986.
Yeah, so this would be your fourth.
Incredible. Yeah, this yes. would be my fourth one that
right.
I've covered there. The amazing thing, and you'll truly appreciate this, it would be on Saturday in 1986, there were 11 players within two shots of the lead, so they were really backed up in the media center. And I was working at that time for WLNG Radio out in Sag Harbor, and we had a mobile studio on the ground. And much to my surprise, on Saturday night, Frank Hannigan, the executive director of the USGA, pulls up in a golf cart, and I see that Greg Norman's sitting in the cart, and Frank says, could you use Greg for a little bit? Because we're backed up at the press center. And Greg came in the mobile studio and was in there for about 45 minutes. It would be the same as you know, they walked into your studio there and you know, say, I'm leading the U.S. Open. Can you spend a little time with Ann Liguori? I mean, it just doesn't happen like that.
I remember. You told me that story. I remember when that happened. And plus, just the fact that WLNG was allowed to bring that mobile studio right so close, right, to all the action?
Yeah, we brought it in on that Sunday before. And the same Frank Hannigan, within 5 minutes of shutting off the mobile studio, he came down and he said, Bob, you got two choices. I said, what's that, Mr. Hannigan? He says, either you get that piece of garbage off the property or you put a tarp over it, because, you know, it was brightly colored in big call letters. I mean, a typical remote station, but certainly didn't fit in at a U.S. Open setting. But So we got a tarp, and then everybody was happy.
Well, I have to say, I've never seen more hospitality tents, probably anywhere, at a U.S. Open than the ones that they've put up. And I think they're still building more over there. It's just there's so much going on over there, but building a lot of – it was pretty – you know, frenetic over there on Thursday. And, you know, there's a little road that they put in to the left of the tee box. I mean, when you get here, Bobby, you're going to have to walk to that tee box, the new tee box, which is 60 yards back on the par 5 16th. You could hardly even see the clubhouse. I mean, particularly in the mist, I took that picture, but it is just so far back. You can't go back any further on a lot of these tees. And then on the 14th tee box, they're almost at the clubhouse. It's that par 4.
I know. I was out there in the fall and noticed that the changes that they're making. And, I think they're good ones. The one thing I'm disappointed in a little bit, I've been informed that the fairways are going to be wider for this U.S. Open than they were in 86 and 95 and 04. And I think the ability of the players has escalated so much that, if anything, the fairway should be narrower. But the USGA has decided to go in a different direction. Oh, by the way, and for your listeners, I'm sure you've been mentioning it, but in case you haven't, the merchandise tent for the U.S. Open is going to be open that Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, prior to U.S. Open week, and nobody needs a ticket. You can just go to the merchandise tent, buy whatever you want. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for those that do not have a ticket to the actual competition. They'll be allowed to go in there, and it's going to be a huge merchandise tent, and it'll be all kinds of stuff in there. And that'll be the week before Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Thanks for mentioning that, Bobby. And you can see the merchandising tent. It's up already from the highway. It's right there as you pull into Tuckahoe Road, right there on the right. So I can't wait for you and Janice to come up. And, as you say, people know you from WLNG right out here on the East End, but you are the voice of golf for Talk Sport Radio in the UK, the voice of golf for World Golf Radio, and you co-host the Grill Room show heard on digital platforms. So you are working round the clock, literally, with all these different time zones. When do you sleep?
Well, I'm a lot like you. I mean, you put a microphone in front of either one of us, and we just go nonstop. I mean, it's going to be on adrenaline that I'll be doing it at the U.S. Open. You will, too. I know you'll have outstanding coverage on WFAN. So between us, we've been addicted to, being in front of a microphone. I've loved golf my whole life. I love radio. To be able to combine the two, I just pinch myself every so often, realizing how lucky I am to do this. And golly, when I think back all the places that you and I, you were so kind to take me on a golf trip to Spain, and we had a wonderful time there. And, the friends you make, and you know this as well as anybody, Ann Liguori, the friends you make in the golf business, it's really a small family when you boil it all down. Everybody thinks that, huge numbers in the media, but the number of people that actually cover it all over the place is pretty small, and we all enjoy one another, and everybody helps one another out. I mean, you've helped me out I don't know how many times, and sometimes if you need something, I pitch in a little bit. So it works out well for all of us.
Well, I have to, that story about the Spain trip, I have to tell it because it's just so funny. I'm trying to remember what tournament we were at. I think we were at a tournament in Florida. Do you remember where we were, which event it was?
I'm pretty sure it was at Honda, but it wasn't at the location that we played now.
Right.
It was at one of the former sites, and you were on the telephone, and you finished the story.
Yeah, so I'm on the telephone. You're sitting in front of me, in the row in front of me, and I'm talking to whoever the PR person was who was arranging this trip to the south of Spain. And she said, you know, we could use one or two more, you know, media personalities to come on this trip, because it was a pre-Ryder Cup promotional trip when the Ryder Cup was at Valderrama, you know, to play all these great golf courses in the south of Spain and to experience, you know, what the south of Spain had to offer. So I said, hold on a second. So I put my hand over the phone and I said, hey, Bob, do you want to go to Spain? And you turned around and you said, yes. And that was it. And I said, I have you know, an extra golfer for you, a media person for you. It's just the way it works. As you say, it's such a great family atmosphere with all the media. And, you know, we kind of travel. You go to tournaments every week. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful group of people, I think. Don't you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you've been blessed to, you know, not only cover golf, but, you know, your involvement in tennis and all the other sports. I mean, you're going to have the author of a great book, I would assume, on Mickey Mantle. I was playing at Westchester Country Club in a pro-am, and I had to wait on one tee because there was a group on the tee waiting to hit, and they couldn't hit. And when I got on the tee, who was standing there but Mickey Mantle? So I said, holy mackerel. I said, hi, Mr. Mantle, can I just shake your hand? And I can still remember this day. I mean, his hand had to be three or four times the size of my hand. So my little hand just disappeared. But he was a gentleman. He loved golf. And obviously the author has a lot of great stuff to tell about Mickey Mantle. But I think he was one of the all-time special people ever to play baseball.
He really was. And what a golfer he was, so passionate about it, Bobby. And I can remember my long sports interview TV series that aired for 17 years. He was the very first guest back in 1989. And we did that show at Mickey Mantle's restaurant right in Manhattan on Central Park South. And he was the best storyteller and could not have been friendlier. I mean, just great memories, just a great storyteller. So I savor that TV show interview. It was the very first in that run of 17 years for my sports interview TV series. And you and I have a lot of good memories with different personalities that we've talked to through the years. The Players' Championship,
you know,
go ahead.
I was going to say, you know what's amazing, Ann? When you say you started that show, which had a great run, 17 years is incredible. But when you opened up with Mickey Mantle, I immediately started to think, well, I want to be an artist, so let me paint something. And I paint the Mona Lisa. That's my first painting. Now where do I go from there?
Well, I have to say.
Start out with Mickey Mantle.
I had, you know, Will Chamberlain and then Ted Williams and Hank Aaron. When I look back at that show, and all these personalities would pop through Manhattan, and I was able to connect with all these legends in sports. And as you said, it aired for 17 straight years. I mean, the people on this show were unbelievable, and I still have this treasure chest of archives. And just like you, you interview all these incredible golfers as they come in. You know, the Players' Championship, you have a couple legends, you know, Tigers playing the weekend. Unfortunately, Phil Mickelson isn't. What a threesome that was. Ricky Fowler. Yesterday, Webb Simpson, 17 under with six straight birdies, on pace to set a new course record. In the zone, he gets to 17. Finish the story.
Yeah, what happened to him on 17, and I've seen it over the years, there was a little bit of uncertainty. He has one of the best caddies in the game. He used to be a PGA Tour player by the name of Paul DeSori, but outstanding gentleman, outstanding family man. He's been on the bag for a long time with Webb. They're very close off the golf course. Webb pulled the club, stood on the 17th tee. Paul sensed that he was uncomfortable, walks over to him, puts the bag down, giving Webb an opportunity maybe to take another club. Webb motions him away. Paul goes away. Webb starts to address the ball. Then, still uncomfortable, Paul comes out again with the bag. Once again, Webb motions him away. And then he finally pulled the trigger and came up short into the water. And, you know, to shoot a 63 on that golf course with a double bogey on the 17th hole, pretty remarkable stuff. There's only been eight guys, and I'm going to give your listeners Ann Liguori nugget because we call you out on tour, the queen of nuggets. You always come up with these interesting facts. But only eight players in history of the 45-year history of the Players' Championship, only eight have also won a U.S. Open. So Webb Simpson will try and become the ninth one tomorrow. He takes a five-shot lead into today. Is that insurmountable? I don't think so. You know, it's over 36 holes. But nobody at the halfway point in this event has ever led by three or more shots and did not win. So he has that working for him. But still, a lot of golf to be played. We'll see if Webb can hold on.
And that, you know, it was so dramatic on that 17th because you knew you could see the indecision, and you knew that wasn't going to bode well for his tee shot. But then it hits the wood parameter of that island green, and it hits hard, and it bounces on the green, and you're thinking, well, maybe the golf gods are going to stay with this guy. But then it rolls off, and so you have this huge, you know, anticipation, like he's going to get on the green with this crazy tee shot. But then it rolls and drops into the water, and you could hear everybody just exhale, right? And so he double bogeys that hole. But what a zone he was in for a while. My goodness.
Well, it was so incredible that the guys he was playing with, especially Johnny Vegas, who on the front nine after putt was going in, Johnny was chuckling a little bit. Then it became more than a chuckle. But by the backside, these putts continued to drop, and Johnny Vegas was just laughing. I mean, he said afterwards, there's nothing. He's never, ever seen anything like that. I mean, putts that were going 90 miles an hour were hitting the back of the cup, jumping up
that.
And going in. But you accurately called it. I mean, he was in this zone where every time he looked at a putt, he thought for sure he was going to make it, and he pretty much did. So we'll see. I mean, it's still a long way to go, and this is a very quirky golf course. I mean, you know, it's well known and notorious for that, you know, island or semi-island par 3 17th. But, you know, a lot of strange things can happen. Do I think Webb Simpson will win? I absolutely do. He's playing well, and that's going to make him a factor. I think you would agree with me, Ann. I mean, his type of game is pretty well suited for Shinnecock, especially if that putter stays hot.
Absolutely. What about Tiger, Bubba? Bobby, what are your thoughts on Tiger's comeback after the four back surgeries, his year so far? I know he was struggling with his irons again this week like he did at the Masters, but he made the cut at least, right?
Yeah, but see, just that last comment you made, it's almost sad in a way because I, along with you, we've gotten to the point where we're celebrating Tiger making a cut. I mean, I don't think that ever happened with Jack Nicklaus. But of course, he didn't have the injuries and you know, all the other personal stuff. Tiger has flashes. I mean, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, you get as many people saying that he's going to win again, and you know, you still have a lot of people that are saying he's going to win a major again. But yet, you know, golf's not easy. And, you know, despite the massive talent that Tiger had, it's starting to level out right now. And, you know, he's even happy making a cut. And he's somewhat being very unrealistic. Every time he shoots 71 to 72, he tells us in the media, well, I could have been at 64 or 65. Well,
We've heard that before, right?
Sure, when you played, I'm sure when you played Shinnecock and walked off, you probably said to your friends, you know, I could have shot four or five shots better out there.
Exactly.
But, you know, that's the way golf is.
I know. So are you irritated with all the attention he continually gets, even though he's, you know, not obviously ever going to be the same Tiger Woods that dominated the game, nowhere near it?
No, I'm not, because, you know, I've been blessed. I've been at all 14 of his major championships. Tiger, quite frankly, has been mighty kind to me over the years and giving some opportunities for interviews. and I respect what he accomplished. I mean, you know, is he better than Jack Nicklaus? I mean, I don't think so. I think Jack's number one. I think Tiger is 1A. You know, Tiger would have to win 19 majors before I could officially call him the greatest that ever played the game. But he's good for the game. And you know this, Ann Liguori. You know that the difference between Tiger and other golfers, non-golfers will pay attention to what Tiger Woods is doing. And non-golfers don't pay attention to anything else anybody else is doing. Maybe Phil Mickelson. But other than that, you know, golfers will follow golfers, but non-golfers will follow Tiger.
You're absolutely right. And what's most intriguing to me about Tiger Woods since his comeback is how his personality has seemingly transformed before our very eyes. He's friendlier. He's enjoying himself. He's smiling a lot. Now, you know, is it contrived? Perhaps he's trying to, you know, he's appreciating his second lease, you know, on life, so to speak. His kids now are old enough where perhaps they can appreciate seeing him out there and playing. And, you know, it's a different Tiger Woods. Do you think it's an act or do you think it's serious? It's true.
Yeah, I don't think it's an act. And I would say this much, Ann. I firsthand have been able to witness the enjoyment you get doing your broadcast, okay? And if for some reason, let's say you had a case of laryngitis for a year and you couldn't do it, when you would come back, you would be really excited just to be able to do the things that you used to do. And
I
think that's what Tiger's going through.
Yes.
I mean, he was on the sidelines. He was watching on TV. His future was uncertain. Now, he's able to compete. He's hitting the ball as far as he can, as far as anybody out there, actually. But, you know, the ability to make every putt that he looks at has vanished. I mean, he's more of a human being now with putting than he's ever been in his life. But he's still convinced that he can win again. He's working very hard. And I'll tell you one thing. He is going to bring an added element to this year's U.S. Open, unlike that we've ever seen. I mean, it'll be the third time he played there. I mean, 95, played as an amateur and had to withdraw, hurt his wrist in the fescue. Pretty good finish in 04, finishing 17th. But next month, when Tiger Woods shows up on the east end of Long Island and is going to tee it up on one of the all-time great golf courses, the only story that's going to be potentially bigger would be Phil Mickelson finally completing his career Grand Slam by winning all of the majors after finishing second, as you well know, six times in the U.S. Open. So if we either get a Tiger Woods victory or a Phil Mickelson victory, we might be on the air for a week straight after it's over with people wanting to hear about how it happened.
I'd love Phil to complete the career Grand Slam. Doubtful that realistically, can he do it? I don't know if he can put four great rounds together, especially at Shinnecock. It's just so tough. And based on, you know, the way he's been playing of late, I know he won a tournament coming in earlier in the year. But I have to say, Bobby, before I let you go, of all the sports personalities I've ever interviewed in my long history, Tiger's the only one that called me a dude. Did you hear that story?
No, I have not.
I'm going to send you the clip. I was at Bay Hill, and Tiger was in talking about the Ryder Cup. Or was it the President's Cup? I can't remember what the press conference was. But I asked him about his clubhead speed, because at the Valspar, he was clocked as having the fastest clubhead speed of anybody on the tour. And so I said, Tiger, you know, what do you attribute your incredible clubhead speed this early in your comeback after four back surgeries? And he said, dude, I really don't know. And he goes on and on and on. And PJ Tour sent out the clip on social media, and it got over 500,000 hits. So Tiger called me dude.
So you're the most. You're the most famous dude in America.
Hey,
now.
Listen. I mean, he could have said dudette, but anyway, I just thought that was funny. His agent said that it was a term of endearment. So I just think, you know, like you, you've been around for a while, and they get so familiar seeing you and answering questions from me and from you that they just, you know, he called me dude. So that was funny. Anyway, Bobby, thank you so much. You're my favorite dude, and I can't wait to see you and Janice up here on the east end of Long Island. I hope you both play in my 20th Anne LaGoree Foundation Charity Golf Classic. It's June 4th at Atlantic this year. Are you guys going to be in town early enough to come over and play in it?
Well, we're working on that right now. Of course, you're going to have the U.S. Open trophy there, and that's certainly a feather in your cap, and you ought to be congratulated on all the money you've raised through your golf tournament each and every year. And if there's any way possible for us to get there in time, we will certainly do that. If not, I hope this is the best one that you ever hold, and because I know next year will even be better. Hey, thanks for having me on, Anne LaGoree. Look forward to working alongside of you when we get to the United States Open at Shinnecock.
Can't wait. Bob Bupka, voice of golf for Talk Sport Radio in the UK, voice of golf for World Golf Radio. You know him from WLNG out here in the East End. Also co-hosts The Grill Room Show, heard on digital platforms. Bobby, always a pleasure. Give my best to Janice, and I can't wait to see you guys. Have fun. Have a great weekend down in Florida.
You too, babe.
Take care. Bob Bupka. All right, we're going to shift gears, talk a little baseball with the co-author of this incredible new book out called A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. Johnny Smith will join us in a few minutes, so don't go away. Sports Interview with Anne LaGoree is brought to you in part by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, and patented Dual Zone Lens Technology. Learn more at peakvision.com. And by Dune Jewelry and the new Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or spot in timeless pieces for men and women. It's dunejewelry.com. My heart's a zero gravity. She's from a cosmic world.
This is John Landis of Bayburger in Sag Harbor, inviting you to join us at the Jam Session here on WPPB on Wednesday nights at 7 for a great hour of jazz recorded live at Bayburger. And please come out and experience the Jam Session live at Bayburger on Thursday night starting at 7 for a true jazz jam Hampton style. Meanwhile, keep your dial tuned to WPPB 88.3 FM Southampton, New York for the best in local public radio.
The following is a public service announcement from 88.3 WPPB. On Saturday, May 12th, the National Association of Letter Carriers will hold their annual one-day food drive to stamp out hunger. Please leave non-perishable food items at your mailbox or your local post office. Your donations help stock food pantries, child care centers, senior centers, group homes, and shelters for domestic abuse. All food collected on Long Island stays on Long Island. Learn more at stampouthungerfooddrive.us.
Join us, won't you, for Radio Deluxe. I'm John Pizzarelli. From high atop Lexington Avenue in the Deluxe living room, along with Jessica Mulaski, we host a show that is great talk and wonderful music. Join us this week, won't you, for Radio Deluxe.
Listen Sundays at 1 on 88.3 FM.
I know she said it's all. You can make it up next time. I know she knows it's not right.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne LaGoree on this Saturday morning. Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere by going online and listening to us at 883wppb.org. And each show is archived on my website at annelagoree.com. Wow, joining me now is one of the authors of this incredible new book out about Mickey Mantle. It's called A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. And Johnny Smith co-wrote it with Randy Roberts. And Johnny joins me now live. Hey, Johnny, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, you are a professor in sports, society, and technology, and an assistant professor of history at Georgia Tech. So you are calling us from Atlanta, Georgia, correct?
That's right. I'm up, and I'm excited to talk to you about Mickey Mantle here as the Yankees and Red Sox have been battling earlier this week. I think baseball fans are ready for what's going to be a thrilling season.
You know, I have to say, Johnny, Mickey's one of my favorite sports personalities to listen about and to talk about. I think I mentioned to you in a text yesterday that he was the very first guest on my long-running sports interview weekly series that aired on regional sports cable networks around the country. And, you know, just such a great storyteller. Of course, I got him later in his life when he could look back on his storied career, and I just thought it was such a special interview, and he was so gracious to me. And you, in this book, A Season in the Sun, you and your co-author Randy Roberts decided to focus on his life in the 50s, on and off the field, and particularly his Triple Crown season in 1956, and I like that about this book, because there's been so many books that have focused, you know, more on the negative side with this alcoholism and the health issues that occurred from that. And so this is really a book about, you know, the legend, the myth, everything really positive about what made Mickey Mantle such an icon, right?
You know, we are interested in some of those questions you alluded to there, you know. How did Americans view Mickey Mantle in the 1950s? Not so much are we interested in how he's been remembered as a tragic hero who at the end of his life was coming to grips with the consequences of abusing his body, but rather we're interested in Mantle's life at the height of his fame and glory, when he was seen as the face of baseball. And it happens in 1956. That's the focus of our book, when he wins the Triple Crown, when he becomes just the fifth player in the history of Major League Baseball to lead both the American League and the National League in home runs, RBIs, and batting average in a single season. And that Triple Crown is special. You know, Americans who followed baseball at that time recognized that what they were watching was unique. Joe DiMaggio had never hit for the Triple Crown. Babe Ruth had never hit for the Triple Crown. Mantle was doing something that marked his place in the history of the game. And in 1956, his performance, those statistics, marked his place in the history of the sport, and they measured his greatness. And so whenever the Yankees traveled on the road that season, fans turned out in droves. The attendance shot up when the Yankees were on the road. People wanted to see Mickey Mantle. They wanted to see the Yankees, and they wanted to see if Mickey Mantle could hit the ball farther than they'd ever seen a baseball player hit the ball.
So he led the league, you know, winning the Triple Crown, as you say, and that's leading the league in, with batting average, home runs, and RBI. And just talk a little bit about what was going on in the world around that time to kind of put things in perspective, Johnny.
So one of the things we look at here is, how do we understand Mickey Mantle in the context of the 50s? And we try to do this on a couple of levels. Number one is, let's remember this is the Cold War. And during the Cold War, baseball has an important place in the country. It's a template for Americanism, where young boys in particular are encouraged to go out and play ball, to play sports. And that's important because a lot of parents were afraid that communists were going to recruit their kids and that there were these subversive forces out there. Parents were alarmed by rock and roll. They thought it was sexually suggestive and it was dangerous that men like Elvis Presley were playing race records. But then baseball, in the eyes of many adults, was seen as a place to teach kids loyalty, discipline, character. And so that meant that a player like Mickey Mantle, who was packaged as a hero, as an ideal role model by sports writers and advertisers, he was the man that kids aspired to be like. You know, kids wanted to get the number 7 jersey on their Little League team. This is when Little League baseball really mushrooms because you have so many families moving out to the suburbs in the 1950s. And so he becomes an idol in the eyes of American youth, But it's, again, at that time when baseball has an important political role. At the same time, we should think about that in the 1950s, baseball is dealing with some different challenges: declining attendance, economic uncertainty, racial tensions as a result of the integration of Major League Baseball. And here's Mickey Mantle. He's the marquee player that every major league owner in the American League wants to promote because he brings the fans out to the crowd. And so even though there are great players in Major League Baseball in 1956, no one could compare to Mickey Mantle in the way that he could draw people in the way that he got fans excited. And so he helped pump up interest in the sport in a way that no other player did in the American League.
Everything kind of came together for him to emerge as a symbol of American, reference for strength and achievement. And, you know, Americans were looking for an idol back then. And, you know, he came out looking, you know, the guy just so good looking. He looked like the star in The Natural, you know, the blue-eyed, blonde-haired boy from the heartland with this, I mean, just raw power and purity at that point. You know, it's just a lot of it was a myth. And as you say, built up by the media. But, you know, they wanted, America was looking for that kind of hero.
Absolutely. And so it's, as you suggest there, it's sort of this, his arrival matches these expectations. You know, when he came to the Yankees in 1951, the sports writers anointed him Superman in pinstripes. You know, he's a teenager. He's supposed to fulfill the cleats of Joe DiMaggio when DiMaggio would retire at the end of that season. He's supposed to be a power hitter who can hit the ball farther than Ruth, who can hit as well as Ted Williams, who could run the bases like Ty Cobb. Well, that's a lot of pressure for a 19-year-old kid who had jumped five classes to join the Yankees. And he doesn't fulfill that expectation in his rookie year. He gets sent down to the minors. He comes back. He tears up his knee in the World Series. And, you know, he's carrying these great doubts. Then his father dies in 1952. And suddenly, not only is he carrying the great pressures of performing well as a young major league player, but now he's carrying the burden of being responsible for his family. You know, being the provider for his mother and his wife. He's going to be a father soon. And over the course of that time period, between 51 and 55, he has a number of ups and downs. Even though he wins three World Series, even though he goes to four All-Star games, he's constantly criticized for not fulfilling these great expectations that Casey Stengel and the New York reporters and the fans have of him. And in fact, in 1955, he was booed in Yankee Stadium, even though he was the best hitter in the American League. And so he really struggled with, what do I need to do to earn the respect and admiration of New Yorkers? And then finally, in 1956, when he puts it all together, he has his best season ever. The reporters start portraying him in a different light. They're less harsh. They're less critical. They're using Mickey Mantle and his great season to sell newspapers.
I mean, he's from, you know, he's a small town kid. He was from Commerce, Oklahoma. His father was a coal miner. He used to come home, and he told me these stories when I interviewed him back in 1989. His father would come home and pitch balls to him until it got dark. And you know, I could imagine how tough it was for him to come to New York, as you say, in the shadow of all these legends, and perform, not only perform, but, you know, try to thrive in under the microscope. I mean, that must have just been so tough.
You know, he had a hard time talking about himself. So when reporters would ask him about how he played that day at the game or how he was feeling, he didn't have the words. You know, he was not an especially articulate guy with the reporters. He was an introvert, except when he was with his closest friends, people he could trust, like Billy Martin and Yogi Berra and Whitey Ford. You know, he was comfortable in the locker room. He was comfortable when they went out as a group. But, you know, being poked and prodded and having photographers snap photos without permission, you know, that wore on him. And like you said, you know, he comes from a place where his father created these expectations from. You know, he was named after Mutt Mayle's favorite baseball player, Mickey Cochran. And so, you know, he immediately, from the time this child arrives, he's being told, your life is going to be attached to you becoming a Major League Baseball player. Now, Mickey loved the game, and he loved his father. But one of his great regrets was that he never told his father that he loved him. You know, but their language of love was really playing the game. And I think for a lot of fathers and sons, they've bonded through sports. And I think that's how a lot of readers can relate to Mickey Mantle's story, that sports is often this mechanism in which men come together and they share a positive experience and they communicate not so much with words, but through action. And that was Mickey.
When I sat down with him in that 1989 interview, Johnny, his eyes welled up with tears when he, you know, talked about his dad and how you know, his dad sacrificed for him so that he could play baseball, and how his father passed of Hodgkin's disease, and his son at the time was still alive and had Hodgkin's disease. And he did say, you know, you've heard this and I'm sure read this in your research, that had he known that, you know, he didn't think he was going to live that long, so he just drank and partied and wanted to just, you know, live each night till the fullest and overdid it. I don't know if you saw that in your research, but he really was very sentimental about his father and about his family.
Yeah, no question. And so one of the things we write about in the book, you know, you asked about context at the time, is how alcohol was the drug of choice in the 1950s. And one of the things that I think readers will find interesting is that if we're going to really understand Mickey Mantle, the icon, and his relationship to alcohol, let's think about it this way. When he's in New York and he goes out to the Copacabana or he goes out to Touch Shores and there are admirers there, being Mickey Mantle meant accepting an offer to take a drink. Everybody there who wanted to be in the good grace of Mickey Mantle wanted to buy him a shot or buy him a beer or send over a bottle of champagne. There was this expectation that as a man, especially as a ball player, that you could drink, and then you could drink hard. You could drink late into the night. And so drinking alcohol is really tied to masculinity, right? Our notions of what it meant to be a man in the 1950s. And Mickey would later explain that, look, you know, in the clubhouse, there was this expectation that you drank hard and you played hard. That was the measure of being a man. And so really the guys in the clubhouse, they admired you. They applauded you. They'd give you a hard time maybe. If you could show up with a hangover and belt one out of the park. And Mickey would later sort of joke and say, you know, look, hitting the home runs when you were hungover wasn't the hard part. It was running around those bases when you were dizzy. But the fact is that, you know, this is a moment in which alcohol pervaded baseball culture. And Mickey came of age during that time.
Right. I mean, you make a good point. I mean, unfortunately, it is still glorified amongst, you know, some cultures and particularly in our society in college, you know, it's cool to drink and be hungover,
right?
And it's glorified, which is, you know, too bad because it's so bad for you. But before we get into how his alcoholism and health issues perhaps diminished his stature and legacy, what, back in 56, then you were talking about, you know, how he did struggle in 55. How did things turn around for him? What turned it around for him the year after?
You know, let's keep this in mind. In 1956, he's only 24. You know, he's maturing as a hitter. He's becoming more patient. He stands deeper into the batter's box, which allowed him to see the ball a little differently. He improves his timing, but I think he was evolving as a batter. He's becoming more selective. In 56 and 57, he hits for really high averages. And I also think that he goes into that season feeling like, you know, I'm finally healthy, relatively healthy for Mickey Mantle. He would still battle some injuries throughout that season, as he always did. But in the 55 World Series, he had a leg injury. He hardly played. And so I think, you know, he's looking at this as an opportunity to redeem himself, and he's really determined. The other thing is this. Mantle had a very contentious relationship with the press in the early years of his career because these writers were the people who built him up just to tear him down. So one time in spring training, he went to Bill DeWitt, who is an executive of the Yankees, and he said, you know, Yogi Berra just won another MVP, but most of my numbers were better than Yogi's. And while I'm happy for Yogi, what do I have to do to win the MVP? And DeWitt said to him, you've got to come out of that shell. You've got to show people who you are. And Mickey understood what he meant. You know, he had to be more willing to be talkative with the press and show them a different side of him. And whether that meant just showing them, hey, here's what I do with the plate, letting them into his life and take pictures of him with his family. And it works. You know, as Mickey is having the best season of his career, he also becomes more marketable. And he establishes Mickey Mantle Enterprises, Inc. And so now suddenly he's making a lot of money as a spokesperson for Gem Razor Blades and Rawlings and Wonder Bread and so on. And so his face is becoming an iconic face during this moment.
And the more popular he got, the more I think the media protected him. I mean, back then they all traveled together, trains, and they all hung out together. It was a whole different scenario now. The players back then weren't petrified of the media exposing every little nuance with no social media, obviously. So back then, I think the sports writers kind of protected him in a way, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the sports writers operated by the code of what you see here and what you hear here stays here. In other words, you know, these reporters, if they had a ball player they were writing about who they could turn into a hero, they made sure that he remained a hero. Their view was, we protect the institution of Major League Baseball, and part of that responsibility means protecting the image of these ball players as heroic. And so, you know, these guys, like you said, they were spending a lot of time with the players, more so probably than the players' wives. They traveled with them on the railroad cars, in the hotels, in the restaurants, and so on. And so they knew these guys intimately. And basically the rule was that if a ball player got caught up in something that could be seen as controversial or negative, that unless it affected the player's ability on the field, you didn't write about it. Now, that culture of reporting, of course, is going to change in the 1960s. In the 1960s, journalists become more probing. This is the age of the Civil Rights Movement, in the Vietnam War, and later in the 70s of Watergate. And so increasingly, reporters are going to look at sports differently, more through a political lens, more through a social lens, cultural lens, rather. And so the reporting is going to change. But really, the curtain, so to speak, gets removed by a ball player, Jim Boughton, who published Ball 4
That's
in 1969.
Right.
And he was the one who really portrays Mickey Mantle for the first time in a negative light in just a few paragraphs, showing how Mickey Mantle wasn't always the one who signed the autographed baseballs that had his signature on them, that he could be crude and ugly and could be a sexist at times. And so this really took, really damaged, I think, Mantle's reputation at that time. And years later, though, I think Mantle would recover from that.
Yes, he did. He was such an icon in our town and throughout Major League Baseball. And I think toward the end of his life, when he came out about his alcoholism and said, you know, I really didn't do the right thing. And when he admitted his faults, I think obviously the city fell back in love with him. We just scratched the surface, Johnny. Let's do this again. We're out of time. But thanks so much for joining me this morning. Good luck with this great book, A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Johnny Smith.
Bye-bye.
And Randy Roberts. Pick it up. You'll thoroughly enjoy it. My thanks to Bob Bubka, our golf buddy and radio commentator, and to Kyle Lynch right here in the studio. I will be back next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. Thanks so much for listening to Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.